This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on children disputes in relationships. I am here today with Miss Freya Rowe from Thomas More Chambers in Lincoln's Inn in London. Freya has been described as being a tactical genius in her work as a barrister. Thank you very much for joining us, Freya.
Hello.
Right, okay. So we're going to be looking at the most commonly asked questions in terms of children's disputes, whether married or not married. So one of the first questions that I'm going to ask Freya for us to talk about is, does a mother and a father have equal rights over their children after a separation?
Well, the short answer is yes, they do. Nowadays, it's automatic that both parents have what we call parental responsibility. And nowadays, as long as both parents are named on the birth certificate as the biological parent, they automatically have parental responsibility.
Equal to each other.
What that really means is that they both have equal rights to consult each other and try to agree significant matters for the child, such as, for example, education, any sort of medical treatment and things like that. It doesn't give parents other rights. For example, I have more rights over this child to decide what to do
because
I'm the mother.
Yeah.
It doesn't do that. It just basically confers fairly basic rights, so that, for example, when parents are separated, they need to try their best to stay amicable so that they can discuss things like which schools that the children should be looking at. That is very often a point of dispute. Realistically, I think it's fair to say that if the children live with one particular parent, the resident parent ultimately perhaps has a little bit more choice realistically over the school for the child, because, for example, geographically, if they're looking at state schools in particular, realistically they're going to have to choose a school that's very near to their area.
But generally speaking, because we get lots of men calling us up and saying,
yes,
look, we've split up, she won't let me see the children, I'm obviously the father of these children, the biological parent to these children, do I have the same rights as the mother? So the answer really is yes, you do.
Yes,
and then
nobody should be dictating to the other parent what happens with the child. Mm-hmm. What the courts look at is essentially the child's rights, because it's what parents tend to worry about is their rights. And you get a lot of people saying, oh, I've got maternal or paternal rights over the child. But the reality is the court is actually interested in the child's rights, and the child has the right to have a relationship with both parents going forward, whether they're separated or not. And there is now a presumption, really, in the family courts that the child should continue to have a relationship with both parents.
Yeah.
The only exception to that, really, is when the courts are looking at welfare concerns, what we call welfare concerns, because obviously there are some situations where one or occasionally both of the parents present some risk to the child. For example, there may be domestic violence in the relationship. If there is domestic violence, of course, that has a very wide definition, because domestic violence isn't just physical violence. It can be emotional abuse, financial abuse, verbal abuse. It's all of those sort of things.
So the court will say, okay, if there is a situation like that, particularly
or say it's between the two parents.
Yes.
So then obviously if they're in separate locations, father or mother moves out, the court will look at where is it safest and,
yes,
and best for the,
yes,
child to be.
Well, that's right. Ultimately, the main issue for the court is what is in the best interests of the child.
Always what's in the best interests of the child.
It's always, that's so really the umbrella.
People tend to forget that, don't,
yes,
they?
Yes, they do.
Well, I'm the mother. Surely I should be making all of the decisions.
Yes.
You know, but I think it's very... Look, relationships break down very quickly sometimes, and tensions can really become high. And you've often got friends, family whispering in your ears, to, you know, really,
yes,
winding up the situation even more, and not really helping. So,
yes,
so I think the thing to remember here is that both parents, the starting point, have equal rights to their children.
Yes,
that's the starting point.
Yes,
and the court will always do, if you end up in court arguing over, you know, who is to see the child and who is not to see the child, it's really what's best for the child that's going to be considered. But
is
there an age that a child can say, well, I don't want to see my mother anymore, or I don't wish to see my father anymore? Is there a legal age where a parent or a child, sorry, can say that?
Well, there is something called Gillick competence, which comes from a case called Gillick, which looks at the ability of the child to form their own views and to have their own wishes and feelings. Because there is an assumption, really, that children who are quite young tend to have the same wishes and feelings as their primary carer. And when children get to an age when they have perhaps a bit more better understanding, a bit more objectivity, they're a bit more independent, they're growing up a little bit, then their wishes and feelings, which are always taken into consideration, but they're given much more weight as the child becomes older.
So
there isn't really a definite age as such.
Right, right. So it's not sort
they,
of... Most people tend to think that it's 16. That at 16,
right,
if a child says, I don't want to see you anymore, then they don't have to. You know,
well,
there is that assumption.
There is, I agree. There is an assumption out there that children can decide for themselves when they're 18 if they want to go and find their lost father and that sort of thing. But the courts don't look at it that way. They look very much at the wishes and feelings of the child being taken into consideration. It's an important part of the Children Act. It basically is Section 1 of the Children Act, if anybody wants to look it up, because there's a number of criteria that the court look at. The emotional needs of the child, the educational,
yeah,
needs of the child, and
what
so on.
What the child's saying themselves.
And their wishes and feelings are part of that.
Yeah.
So it's not the entire... The fact that a child says, I don't want to see my father, for example, isn't the end of it. That
for
doesn't
the father,
determine...
It's not the end,
yes,
of it for the parent.
That's
that
right.
They're saying they don't want to see. The parent can still say, look,
yes,
I want to try and get access to you as my,
well,
child.
Well, that's right, because the child, first of all, is that their true wishes and feelings, because sometimes children are put in a very difficult position where the parents hate each other, and the child is going to be loyal to the resident parent, essentially.
But this is the thing. I think that what we have to remember, or what people have to remember as grown-up adults who have chosen to have a child together, is that your problems should not reflect and,
absolutely,
resonate to the children.
Yes.
It is that when we have cases where children are in court being assessed by CAFCAS, or a judge, it's really unpleasant to see. It's really difficult for the child. So I think to do everything as two people, whether it's through a third party, a mutual friend, a family member who's remained mutual in your separation that can help you to get your children's arrangements organised, I think the first rule should be try to keep any children's matters that are not of a serious high abusive level or anything like that out of the courts, really.
Yes,
fair,
yes, absolutely.
Very
I agree.
Stressful for
there,
children.
There are adult
very
issues,
distressing.
Adult issues, which the children really don't need to know about. It's very tempting for a lot of parents to tell their children things about the other parent, which are very negative,
yeah,
particularly
or
in situations.
Hear the parents talking to the friends or family,
yes,
members,
and they do need
this,
to be.
He did that.
Absolutely, they need to be very, very careful, because it's very tempting to say, for example, "Oh, he's had an affair," or "She's had an affair," or talk about money
and
how,
yeah,
horrible they've been, and so on. But all of those are adult issues, and all that ultimately tends to happen in that type of scenario is that eventually the child will become quite resentful about being used in that way, essentially. And the best thing to do is to really try to encourage the child to see the other parent, to be positive about the other parent.
To the child. To, you know,
yes, to the child.
As a parent. You don't need to say he was a great husband or a great partner or
she was a
great wife.
Because there's a big difference between being a great husband or partner or great wife and being a good parent. And I think people do need to recognise that. And also acknowledge that the wishes and feelings of children often fluctuates and changes. Yeah. Sometimes parents influence their children's wishes and feelings.
I think the older the child, that's very common, more common than we like to think. I mean, I think children undoubtedly get influenced by the parent that they're spending more time with, perhaps living with most of the time, because they're under their guise and they hear their conversation and they have those feelings floating around. And I'm not saying it's easy. It must be really difficult. It obviously is very difficult. It can be very difficult for a parent to speak positively about the person with whom they split up with, be it the wife or if they were just a partner or a husband, and try to say, look, that person is still a good dad or still a good mother, because it conflicts with what your emotions
are. Well, that's right. And if they've been horrible to you, then you worry as well. Perhaps they might be horrible to the child, but that it doesn't go that way necessarily. I think it's quite important to do things like, for example, have a photograph of the other parent with the child, so the child has that, for example, in their room.
Yeah.
Preferably at both houses, so that the child feels that they're being emotionally permitted, really, to have a good relationship with the other parent.
Yeah.
And really try to keep their own personal feelings out of it. It's not a black and white issue. The courts, for example, presented with a case where, let's say, a mother says, oh, he doesn't want to see his father anymore. That won't be the end of it. The court will want to know, why doesn't that child want to see this father?
And
is there a good reason? There may or may not be a good reason. Yes. If there isn't a good reason, then ultimately the court will look at, has that child's been either deliberately or accidentally influenced in their decision-making about the parent? And sometimes there are cases where people talk about implacable hostility and they talk about parental alienation. They're quite big topics and they're quite big topics for the court. And if anybody's interested, there is a very good website called Family Law Week, which is used and contributed to by lawyers. And there are a lot of articles on there and cases on there about these issues, because they're quite big issues.
And then we've got sort of, what can a parent do if the other parent is preventing them from seeing their child? So whether it's the mother or the father, because we've had probably
both.
More cases where mothers say to fathers, you're not seeing the children this weekend, I'm not allowing you to take them for the, you know, pick them up from school. It's very common. But we also have fathers who remain the resident parent and say to the mother, you've been horrid, you're not going to take the children and you're not going to see the children. Can one parent prevent another parent? And if so, what's the first step someone should do if they're in that situation?
Well, I think they can prevent the child seeing the other parent, because ultimately, although there isn't a legal obstacle stopping the parent from taking the child and going off and spending time with the child. There's nothing to stop them from actually taking the child. But the difficulty is that, of course, if you do that, you're likely to make the situation much worse, because the child will be very upset, particularly if there is an actual big scene where the child is sort of forced away from one of the parents. And they'll be very exposed to quite a lot of unnecessary upset. Sometimes people even involve the police in that sort of situation.
Well,
it can create quite a drama for the child. And so I think that's really what prevents people from going against the wishes of the other parent more than anything else.
And I think one of the first things that we say to people is, if you've come into that situation, keep a diary. Keep a diary of what's going on. So on this day, I had a plan to see the children. I went to see the children. This is what happened. Because if you are to try and go to court or to a lawyer and say, look, I'd like to get access to my children, my partner's not allowing me to see them, they're going to say, well, when and how?
Yes, what
and
have you done
And most people
to try?
Don't keep a diary. Write down what's going on. I think that's important. So you've got something to say, look, you know, even if it ends with a lawyer's letter, just a lawyer's letter sorts the problem out, because everybody comes to their senses and realises that you shouldn't keep the children from each other. At least you can say, well, and this is the occasions where you try to withhold the children and this is exactly what was done. That can sometimes resolve it. But what's the next stage from there?
Well, the first thing to try to do, if you're amicable enough to do this, which is the ideal, is to sit down with each other and actually go through a calendar and work out what is actually realistic, because it depends very much when people work, what sort of where they live, are they going to be living close by to each other, because that obviously makes it much easier if you're going to have contact or if you're going to have a sort of shared care type situation.
But generally that's
but
really
if they can't do that, it is very hard.
Yeah, because if you've got the issues between
that's
the
what
two
I suggest.
Adults,
if of course not in situations where there's domestic violence or something like that. If there's a good reason why a parent is stopping the child from seeing the other parent, for example, domestic violence and things like that, or there's some risk because the parent is using drugs or using is an alcoholic,
so worried that harm can come to the
has
child,
some psychiatric problem or something like that, is genuinely worried about risk, then of course none of this applies. You wouldn't expect people to sit together having amicable conversations. You'd expect them to protect their child, because your duty is to do
but
that,
but you've got to prove that.
But otherwise,
and I think it's important to say
right, not just to make up allegations.
Lots of occasions where people come and say, oh, you know, they neglect the children when they have them, they don't feed them, they don't put them to bed on time, they drink in their presence, but then actually none of that is happening, because and they can't prove it that it's happening. And I know it's difficult to prove that if the other person partner takes the children and they're drinking. How do you prove that? You've got to sort of almost cross-examine your own child when they come home, and that's a horrid thing to do as well. So I think it's important to just also consider that things, you can't just say it, you've got to have some proof that that's happening, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think that if there aren't these sort of serious issues, then the best thing to do is try to keep communication lines open. If people really can't speak to each other without getting unpleasant, then perhaps do it by email. Email suggestions about contact.
Or a third party mutual.
Or use a mutual
friend,
third party,
mutual
absolutely.
Family,
if there's someone
that
who's sort of quite
managed.
Neutral, preferably. Somebody who's managing to stay quite neutral about matters might be quite helpful. If none of that works, then of course parties are nowadays expected to go to mediation before embarking on court proceedings, unless there is an exception to that rule, for example, something like domestic violence, because obviously you wouldn't want to sit in a room trying to mediate with somebody who is a domestic violence perpetrator.
So mediation. We're mentioning it for the first time, so just to quickly just give a snapshot of mediation, really, it's where you, with your partner, go and there's an independent third party trying to go between you and have discussions between you to come to some sort of agreement. On it doesn't matter how small the questions and topics are, like who has the children for their birthdays, half a day each or a day before or a day after, and that's what mediation is, to help you both agree on matters through an independent third party.
That's right, and it can be very successful, and certainly the courts expect people to try that before they simply just make a court application, unless there's good reason not to. If, of course, that fails, then the only option really is to instruct lawyers or to represent yourself, which is becoming more common now, and to make an application.
Through a direct access barrister,
absolutely. You can go directly to barristers. Most barristers now do.
What that means is you go directly
to the barrister,
and you don't go to a solicitor's firm as the first point, which can be quite cost effective. And in my view, it actually does cut out a lot of work that could be done at the beginning that may not need to be done. I mean, one of the other things that I did want to mention is contact centres. And I know that's that comes later on in maybe part two of this children disputes episode. But contact centres, which I came across only a few years ago, are very, very helpful, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Freya, where both parties, the communications have fallen through, so they can't communicate directly with each other about their children. They can't communicate through third parties who are friends or family, because everyone's too busy with their own lives. So they've all gone to lawyers.
Yes.
But it doesn't need to necessarily get contentious and, go to court straight away, does it? Whereas
no.
if one lawyer says, look, what about a local contact centre, yes. which is an independent place, a unit,
yes.
and one of the contact centres actually near us is a church hall.
Yes.
But
yes.
people volunteer
yes.
where mum drops or dad drops the children off at an agreed time,
yes.
dad's there or the other parent is there, stays there at the contact
yes.
centre with the children
yes.
to start building up a relationship if there's
yes.
been a long time since they've seen each other. And that can go on for months
yes.
before they say, we're actually a little bit more amicable enough to say, well, I'll pick them up from the McDonald's today or
yes.
grandma's house or
yes.
meet us at the park and we'll hand them over there. So that
yes, that's very helpful. I
yeah.
mean, the contact centres are very, very helpful. There's a very good website, which is NACCC. It stands for National Association of Child Contact Centres. And if you tap onto that and tap into your local area or your postcode, it comes up with the whole range of accredited contact
yeah.
centres, which
yeah.
offer supported contact or supervised contact.
They're wonderful places.
And
for
they
it.
Are. They're very,
honestly,
very helpful.
And
the volunteers are very, very good.
Oh, they're fantastic.
And there is a difference between supported contact and supervised contact. It's cheaper to have supported.
Subject,
yes,
isn't it?
It is. It's much cheaper to have supported contact. You still have to pay usually a referral fee, and then there's an amount per hour, and you have somebody always present, but they're not necessarily actually listening and watching everything that's being said, and they
mm-hmm.
won't make notes of what's going on in the contact. If the concerns are a bit higher than that, then probably a supervised contact centre would
if
be
you're
better.
Worried that, you know,
if you're worried that they might say something really awful or do something
yeah,
awful
yeah.
or try and snatch the child or something like that, because supervised contact centres are very professional. They cost a bit more, but you would have proper supervision of everything being said and done. There are also notes taken at the time
yeah.
as to what is said and done.
Yeah.
And that can be quite reassuring for the other parent, because if they have these worries that the father or the mother may not turn up or may turn up drunk or
yeah.
may misbehave or so on, and then they look back at the contact notes, they can see for themselves that actually the contact has gone very well
yeah.
or
yeah.
not.
And it can be a building block to actually
it's a good starting
improving the
point.
Contact
Absolutely.
With the child. I mean, you know, these centres, I think, are absolutely brilliant because they give an opportunity for two people where the relationship has broken down to bring the children together
yes.
and have some contact
where
yes. they're not saying, oh, I'll just drop them off to your house, if they're worried, well, who's going to be at your house? And
yes.
and you know, so they are really helpful.
They're
really
very
useful.
Very helpful. The other thing is to think about wider family, because it may be that there's somebody in the family who both parents would trust.
Well, we've had cases
of supervised contact. Yes,
the court
support
has ordered
the contact.
That, you know, a certain family
yes.
member who was put forward and
yes.
agreeable to both parties would always be there
yes.
when the child would be dropped off to the other parent or, you know, picked up by the other parent.
Yes.
And that, I thought, was a great way to do things as well. As
yes.
long as, obviously, both parties can agree to that. I mean,
yes.
look, I
or
mean,
a friend. Sometimes it's a bit more neutral to have a mutual friend. Sometimes family can't really stay neutral. That can be a problem. Sometimes they don't want to get involved because you need somebody who would do this regularly. They are very busy.
You need somebody
who's regular.
Every week I'll come along
yeah.
and I'll make sure that I'll be the supervised contact. But look, I mean,
I would also say that I wouldn't personally recommend starting supervised contact if there are serious issues of domestic violence.
No, of course.
Because one of the things to think about is there ever going to be a safe exit route from the supervised contact? Because, for example, if somebody has quite a serious problem and they are a domestic violence perpetrator, but they're not going to acknowledge that they have that problem or get the help that they need, which could in fact be available to them. There are a lot of courses for domestic violence perpetrator type programs. But if they're likely to be the sort of person who's just going to deny everything all the time and say they've never done anything wrong, then it may not be safe to start contact even in a supervised contact centre, because ultimately contact centres are usually used quite short term.
Yes,
as a reintroduction.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So very often for 3 months, maybe occasionally 6 months, very rarely longer than that. And so you have to think about, is it a good thing for the child to have contact with the other parent at all? Because clearly, if it's a case where they're going to be reintroduced to the parent to have contact, supervised in the contact centre, but then in fact contact can never come out of a contact centre,
it may be a longer term solution.
And if there isn't one, it may actually not be a good idea to reintroduce the child back to that other parent if they have very serious problems, for example, drug addiction and things like that, and they're not going to get the help that they
need. And I mean, I think it's really important just to mention, because we had a case not long ago that, you know, people think drug addiction is for people on the lower end, the lower scale of life, where, you know, you don't have much money and you're addicted to sort of street drugs. It's not.
We've had very...
sort of higher profile, professional working people with drug addiction problems.
And mixed age groups, mixed classes.
Absolutely.
And so, yes. But it is a very good way to start contact if you can.
Through contact centres or through other supervision,
yes.
Excellent. Well, Freya, thank you ever so much. I think this was a very, very helpful start to our introduction, and I know that we have got so many more questions that we will be answering in a part two episode, and also questions that people have sent in that we'll be looking at answering as well. So don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also, visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you very much for listening.